You're listening to the Scaling Culture podcast, where we sit down with thought leaders who share their experiences building incredible workplace cultures. Our guest today is Rick Jackson, Executive Vice President of Engagement and Enablement at Deutsche Post DHL Group. During his 18 years with the company, Rick has gained a wealth of experience and expertise in various parts of the business. Rick works closely with all business units to engage, enable, and empower employees across the globe. In his current role, he focuses on building engagement and motivation through the certified program, embedding the leadership attributes framework, driving first choice, a continuous improvement program, strengthening the group's approach to inclusion and diversity, and mastering the ability to embrace change. In this episode of Scaling Culture, Ron and Rick discuss DHL's company-wide cultural revolution and its lasting impacts, how to effectively build an empathy and mindfulness across your organization, how DHL scaled culture to a point where tens of thousands were bought in, the importance of being bold and taking risks, and why keeping that startup mindset might just be your winning ticket.
Welcome to another episode of the Scaling Culture Podcast. I'm your host, Ron Lovett, and today we have Rick Jackson, Executive Vice President of Engagement and Enablement at DHL. Rick, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you, Ron. Very good to be here.
Well, I've already had the pleasure of getting to know you a few minutes off air, and we were starting to talk about your title, and I had you stop. I need to understand enablement. I'm just curious. Tell me about that part of your title, and then we'll rewind a little bit and get in your story. But I saw that, and yeah. I said, "What does that mean?"
You and everyone else, to be fair, Ron. It's funny because it's a title that we discussed in the organization when we started to pull together what I do, which we'll talk about in a little bit, I'm sure. I was talking to the CEO because it was the CEO who started to have this discussion. Myself, the CEO, and the head of HR for our organization. And we were talking about what is it that we're going to actually do with my role in the organization, because we designed it specifically to strengthen our culture across the organization. And we played around with all sorts of ideas. And really, in essence, if you think about it, it's like the chief culture officer for the organization. That's really what it is. But we said, look, we don't really have chiefs. It's a thing. Apart from the CEO. So what we said is, why don't we say exactly what's in the tin and what I'm actually doing? And the whole premise of what we're trying to do with the culture is engage and enable the organization to really thrive in this cultural space. So we said, well, there you go. You know, we did say empower as well, but I said, no, it's way too long. So we said, let's just call it engagement and enablement. And that's what we do. We engage the organization to enable them to really thrive in what they do and to enable them to be stronger and to be their own self and their authentic self. And then we empower them to really lead. So let's say all our leaders across the organization. Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. I haven't heard that. So that's the first. And now I understand it. I think it makes perfect sense. Yeah. And I think that's great. And so, Rick, you've got an interesting background, not a path that most go on, i.e., you were talking about earlier when we were catching up that you were IT, moved chief of staff, and then got a role with the global CEO to help with culture. But because usually I would say, you know, what got you interested? But it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, those around you saw a gift that you had and said, let me get that gift closer to me to help me do something on the people side. They weren't having you adjust their BlackBerries all day.
Yes, that's true, thank God, because that's the last thing I can do, to be fair.
So bring us there. Tell me more about that.
Well, I was working in an IT, so my IT background stemmed from university. So I actually studied pure and applied mathematics and computer science whilst I was at university. You know, it was early 90s, and that was the thing to do. You know, computers were going to be the big thing coming moving forward. So I thought, well, that's obviously where the money is, to be fair, let's face it. So I thought, let's go in that direction. I think it's fair to say I was okay. It wasn't my favorite thing in the world, but what I did like about it was more the people side of it, how we work as people with IT, how we really understand how we can improve our lives through IT and what does that really mean. And it was the people side that really got me into it. So when I went to work, I looked for roles within IT organizations that were driven by business. So not necessarily the technical programming side, but more the business side of IT. So it always was driven by the people and what the business wanted. So it was more the business requirements side. But it came to the point when To be fair, I'll just step back a bit. I never really said no to anything in my career. It's one of the things that I've not done. I've never said no. So when anyone said, do you want to try this? Do you want to try something different? I've always sort of gone, okay, well, let's see how it goes. And, you know, I can always do something different if it doesn't work out. So I've sort of taken that risk. But yeah, I went from the IT world. I've worked within DHL for 20 years. So 20 years ago, I started in the IT organization of a UK business, which is just one business of DHL. So DHL is a big business. I don't know whether you know the structure of DHL. Do you know the structure of DHL, Ron, or do you want me to give you a bit of a...
No, please give us an overview. I mean, I know it's a global business, but I don't think I quite understand the depth. Even talking now, I'm like, well, this is much bigger than I thought. I thought it was a local company and there was a mother and father that owned this and their three sons worked at it. No, I'm joking.
You're not far from the truth. It started, though. It started with three guys, D, H, and L. Dawson,
oh, wow.
Yeah. It started in 69 with three guys, Dulcie, Hilberman, Lynn, D, H, and L. And then it just became bigger and bigger and bigger and became a global conglomerate around the world and was bought by Deutsche Post, which is the German post organization, to become the biggest logistics provider in the world. So as a group, the DHL group now has around 600,000 people. We have many, many businesses all over the world. We're in every single country of the world. So we are the world's most international company, arguably. I don't find, or I've not found, any company that's in more countries of the world than we are. And our businesses have our express business, which you would recognize from people delivering parcels every day in the morning and through the day, and the vans on the road. We have the Deutsche Post, the German Post organization. We have our global forwarding and freight business, which is more your ships, your charter aircraft, movements of freight and forwarding business around the world. We have our supply chain business, so the warehousing, the end-to-end supply chain. And we have our e-commerce business, which is around 17 countries of e-commerce businesses we've got now around the world, dealing with our businesses within country of our e-commerce and cross-border e-commerce business. So we have many, many businesses that make up this 600,000. And I was in the express business in the UK, in their domestic business to start. And it was through that I started to work through the IT position into the European IT function, where I worked on the commercial side. So looking at the sales and our customer services organization from an IT perspective across the European region, what do we actually do? And it was that switch that took place during that tenure. So I was in Brussels in our European headquarters. We had a new CEO for Europe. And that new CEO wanted a chief of staff. And to be fair, I didn't apply. We were having conversations.
Because that wouldn't have been a natural journey for you. Yeah.
But it was out of any realm of something that I thought I would be interested in. But I met the CEO and we chatted and he said, no, I want you to do this. I think you need to start and you start next week. And so I literally over the weekend changed my role from being a program manager in the IT organization in Europe to being the chief of staff for the CEO, running his office. And I did that for 4 or 5 years. And all credit to him. He taught me how to run a business, how to run a P&L, how to notice what was going on, how to work with people, how to not work with people, and everything was in the mix.
But Rick, he, I have to go back there for a sec because he really took this is a big business at the time, and he took a big risk on you because he saw something in you to say, I'm going to let you learn in this key role. I mean, that is a really interesting leadership quality. And a risk. He saw something that thought, okay, the barriers aren't too bad. He'll pick this up quickly because he taught you how to do the role almost. Am I correct?
And I'll never forget in the first week, he said to me, this is going to be like doing a fast track MBA in real time on the ground. And he was not wrong. He was not wrong. And I was involved in everything about running a European organization. With every facet of it, I was involved in and understood what was going on. So it really was like running a fast track MBA for two or three years.
And it sounds like you were drinking from a fire hose, but you were stepping into your gifts that maybe you didn't know you had.
Yeah, and I really do believe that. And one thing that I always think about, because people ask me this question a lot, I find, and I think it's because of my background in IT and mathematics, I think differently than many other people in this space. My mind works in a different way, and I can't pinpoint what it is. And I wouldn't want to say, you know, it's one thing or the other, but the way I seem to think about things and the logic I use when I'm trying to solve something or engage with someone or work with different groups of people does work differently than many people in this space that I'm in now, in the cultural space. And I do think that that's the way that programming, computer programming and mathematics really taught me to think. And it was the biggest thing I took out of my degree. And I think that's what has helped me in this space. I really do think that. I really believe it.
Well, I can tell you already that it would be an intense critical thinking with a detailed analytical brain that is mixed in there. Like that would be really helpful to someone who's, you know, a CEO, president level, is trying to think high level strategic and really lacking those types of details. It sounds like you can really get into the weeds and you know, from a critical thinking standpoint, analyze things quickly. And that's a fantastic skill.
Yeah, it was a great experience. And, you know, I'll never, ever look back on that and think that there was anything ever negative about it, because it has literally built my life from that positioning. Because it was only when he left the organization, we got a new European CEO, but we also had a new global CEO. And that global CEO that was running Europe at the same time for some months, he was the guy that really changed my life, because he said to me at that point, I want you to do something for us with a team. There were six of us at the time. He said, I want you to start to really look at the culture of our organization. Now, at that point, and this is recorded everywhere, I'm not really giving out any confidences of things I know here, the business was losing an awful lot of money. So we were losing, the Express organization was probably losing €1 billion a year.
Rick, what year was this? Sorry to interrupt. What year?
2009.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And our engagement scores with our people and our leadership scores, when we looked at our employee opinion survey, they weren't rock bottom, but they weren't great. They were around the 60s, 63, 64%, which is not good. And so we really wanted to drive a change of culture across the organization. And this is where I believe he took a risk and said, we are going to really transform this organization from the grassroots up, all the way through all of our businesses across the world. And we are going to change the culture of what we are as an organization. We're going to focus on what's important, which is our time-definite international business in this Express world. And we will instill the values of our organization across the world in every single country consistently. It doesn't matter whether you were going to be a courier in Guatemala, or you were a key account manager in Japan, or you were the CEO of Uruguay, it didn't matter. You were going to go through and understand exactly what this company was all about from the moment it started in 69 all the way through our organization. And it started to build the sort of a motivation of the development and engagement of our 100,000 people across the world, that we really started to look at and say to them, what is it that you really need to be engaged within our organization?
And Rick,
and that's what happened. Look,
this is a huge problem that you were brought in to solve, and I think this is fantastic. Before we get on that side, I'm just curious, what got the company there? Like, if you had to summarize very quickly, here's what got us there to a point where we weren't scoring well. We knew when we looked in the mirror, Houston, we had a problem. What got the company there?
I think it was a mix of different things. I think it was from an engagement and a cultural level, it was primarily, and this is my view on this, and I really do believe it's true. When the business started to expand, Deutsche Post started to build businesses to become the biggest logistics company in the world. So they bought DHL. They bought lots of domestic businesses all over the world, clumped them all together and said, you're now all called DHL.
Right.
And I think there was all best intentions to make it work and really become this behemoth in the industries to take on the likes of UPS and FedEx and all the big companies around. The challenge with that was you were bringing together so many different cultures from across the world into one business that didn't mesh. And it was about
also
trying to work with people to understand what was important.
But it was probably also a financial and operational exercise that wasn't focused on culture either. It was probably like, look, let's amalgamate, let's roll this thing up. They probably weren't like, okay, what are we going to do with the cultures? It was just like, you know, I don't know. I'm making the assumption that maybe it wasn't about, maybe that wasn't part of the strategy either back then of the culture piece versus
obviously. That's the strategy, because nobody, there was no, from what I could understand, bringing together of these different cultures when they started to merge them. Now, of course, there was in that lots of loss-making businesses that were bought into the group. Now, the CEO also worked with those businesses to either move them, close them, or transform them. So that was what really led to that, combined with the looking at the culture and the people, drove the business up in the organization. And we had, from 2010 to around 2015, let's say, the engagement scores leapt in the organization, and the leadership scores leapt from around the mid-60s right through to around, I think in 2015, I think it was around 80, 81 in the organization. We also were making $1 billion by then. So we've really transformed the organization, and a lot of that was down to, I don't want to use any buzzwords because I hate buzzwords, but it's more around like the way the service profit chain works. And I'm sure everybody's aware of that. But if we do have this group of people in our organization who are absolutely engaged and motivated to work for the business and be in the business because they enjoy it, they love shouting, I'm going to work on a Monday morning and I'm going home on a Friday, great. If you've got that, the quality that they give in the organization, the productivity is huge and it increases tenfold.
Look, I agree, Rick, but let's go back to, okay, Houston, we have a problem. We bring you in to help us solve this. We have to rebuild this thing from scratch, essentially, you know, being a little dramatic, I guess, but lots of work to do. The scores are low. What was the first step? Like, what was the starting point?
We, at that point, knew that we needed to get everybody on the same page. So we needed to ensure that everybody understood where we'd come from as an organization. We needed to make sure that they understood the values of our organization and what we stood for.
So how'd you do that?
Well, we, with the board, so, and this was really quite an interesting idea because in essence, and this is where, you know, it can cause various arguments against and for, and there's no real right answer to this, but the CEO did something quite different here. He took all of this, just as a preface to what I'm about to say, he took all of this and he actually said, I want to deal with this outside of the HR organization, because the HR organization needed to focus on what we were doing as an organization, transform the business from the sort of, let's say, the grassroots and getting the basics right, whilst he, under me and a couple of others in the organization, we needed to transform the cultural side of it. So he took responsibility of it. So we sat with him and with our COO at the time, and we were looking at the values and saying, what is it that this business really stands for? What is it that we've got to focus on that's driving the profit in our organization? And that was where we said, well, look, it's our time-definite business. Well, what does that mean? What does our time-definite business mean? And we looked at the values that go with that. So we said, people have the passion to be in the organization. They have this can-do spirit of what we want. They have to get everything right the first time because it's super important for the customer and for the operation. And as an express business, we have to do everything with speed. So we realized that these were really the values of our organization, and that's what we wanted to instill across the organization. So it was just a case of exploring conversation, pinpointing exactly what it is that we wanted, and then really then saying, right, if we combine that with educating people about what our business is all about, we are starting this base understanding to get everyone in the world consistent about what this business is. And that's, in essence, what we did. That's how we started.
So I understand the strategy, but I'm just trying to bring me into the, if you don't mind, Rick, bring me into the experience of, what's a far off country that I think you would say before, Ghana, or are you somewhere? What's a far off country that you would have very small operations?
The world, so choose one. There's only one country in the world we're not in, Ron. You can guess what that is, but every other country we're okay.
Okay. So let's take a far off. I'm going to say Nigeria, Ghana, something like that, right?
Okay, Nigeria's fine, yeah.
Okay, Nigeria, right? I was actually there last fall. So let's just say you're in Abuja, Nigeria. And if I'm a frontline DHL driver, and yesterday, no real focus on culture, switch from the CEO, by the time that gets to me, this focus on the values, how do I see that? How does it show up to me? I'm very curious how it, because this is a big, you know, it's English, the language, fine. So let's assume they're speaking English, so you don't have to worry about the English piece or the translation piece. But how did it get to me as the frontliner?
So, well, in essence, what we did, I'll just give you a thing of what we did here, because you just mentioned something that's super important, which is the translation. But what we, in essence, did was we created a day and a half program that explored the values and what they meant, explored what it meant to the people in their daily role, gave people an understanding no matter what role they did, how they fit into the organization, and talked about the history of the company, what products we have in our organization, the operation itself, our sales structures and what we do, how we work in customer service, what does it really mean for us when you bring it all together in relation to what you do in your local environment. So we built a day and a half program that explored that, and we made it very clear that every single person would have to go through it in the world, all 100,000 people. And we did them in a year. Or just
online? Was it online?
No. Everyone had to come together. Wow. So we spent, in that first year, about 60 million delivering this.
Wow.
And it was, people had to come together. They would stay over in a hotel. They would have a dinner so they could network with people and colleagues in their own environment. And there's two important factors that would come with it, or three. One is translation. We vowed at that point that we would translate everything that we do within this space into the number of languages required to cover 95% of our population.
And this is before AI, by the way.
Yes, it is. And it was a very tumultuous time to translate all that. But we worked with many companies to get that done. And so we translate everything within that business, and we still do today, and this was 13 years ago, into 42 languages, because they can cover 95% of the population adequately enough. That was the first thing. The second thing was we wanted to ensure that people felt attached to what we were trying to do. Now, one of those things is that they get it in their own language. But the second thing is we needed them to all relate to something in a way, and we wanted them to be certified in the fact that they'd just gone through something. So we created a passport. And it's, I should have got my passport. I don't think I've got it with me. We and I've got it, I'll get it out. We
it's a certification.
A certification, a passport, yeah. Where everybody got a passport and they had a stamp put in their passport. So it doesn't matter. And I could challenge everybody, actually, to be fair. I could do. Anybody who goes to see a DHL courier or sees a courier on the street, ask them about their passport, because they should be able to show you their passport.
So is this like a company ID / iPass, you know, this integration?
Yeah. So everyone gets a passport log.
Oh, wow. Look at that.
And it has, this is mine. So everyone gets one. The CEO, everyone down. Every courier CEO, everyone gets one. It has stamps, stickers, messages. Wow. You have a passport page. So you have the set with your passport photo on.
Wow.
And your name. Okay. It's really cool. But it gave everyone something to connect to all over the world. And this was only the very first intervention, the very first stamp that goes into it. And then the third thing was, when we knew we were going to deliver this, because it was going to be such a mammoth task, we didn't want people outside our organization to deliver it. So we made all our leaders deliver the program. We took them away. We gave them facilitation skill. We gave them the skill. We broke them down, built them back up, and they delivered it. The senior leadership in every country delivered it to the organization.
I love it. A couple questions. One, who had the idea? Was it a collective idea of the passport? I just think that's really innovative and a really thing to bond everyone together, which I love. And also, it's kind of connected to your business. I think it's very interesting.
Well, it actually came from the US. So there was one of a colleague of mine, a guy called Chris Gillett, was doing something similar in the US alone with regards to engaging the organization in the US prior to us even starting this globally. He was the one that created that whole idea of what do we do with the passport? How do we certify people? And that's just grew and grew and grew. And then we adopted it and just then entered it across the whole world into every single market. Yeah.
And so I'm curious, what does that look like today? If I was to join DHL today, do I do a day and a half, but is it in person now? Is it online? What does it look like today? That's evolved.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because if you join the Express business, yes, you will do the day and a half and then you will have a full journey through the organization. So now we have, I think, 160, 170 different programs. That's just the one. We have about 160, 170 programs now within the Express business that we've developed over the past, say, 13 years. But now all our other businesses in DHL took it up in 2015. So when we get to that point, in 2015, that's when I took the responsibility for the group to do it. So we then have now all businesses, all people across the world in every business should have a passport, an idea of what we do in the certified space. And that's what we called it. Was in Express, it's the Certified International Specialist. In Supply Chain, it's the Certified Supply Chain Specialist.
Right.
In Global Forwarding business, it's the Global Forwarding, you know.
I'm curious, Rick. I don't know if you remember that part of my book, Outrageous Empowerment, when I went through my own cultural transformation, and I state in the book I got it wrong. And when I say got it wrong, or at least the learning for me was, I had created an onboarding program in values, and then I was, you know, similar to your story, I was then onboarding, and I didn't have certification. I wasn't that sophisticated back then, but I was certainly. Having our folks go through an onboarding program, I would hire new people. They would go through onboarding. And then it hit me. I haven't screened for I'm now trying to push my values down someone's throat who isn't aligned. I hired the wrong person. Was there an exodus? Was this new program, this transformation, not for everybody? What happened?
No. Well, was there an exodus? No, there wasn't. Did certain people leave our organization? Not at that point, but what we did 2 years later was really started to look at our leadership programs and how we expected our leaders to behave. So this wasn't for the general population of all 110,000 at that point. It was more about the leadership.
Okay.
At that point, there was a few people who thought, I'm not aligned with this. I don't know whether I can actually implement something like this. So yes, but I wouldn't under any way say there was any exodus across our organization. No, in fact, it probably was the opposite. We noticed that we had better attrition. So we knew that people were staying because they were engaged in what the company was really all about, right? Because what we gave them was a really experiential experience. We invested in their own sort of engagement and motivation to educate them, let's say, as to why what they do is so, so important. And so people really got it. They understood it. They felt connected. And in a way, they felt like they belonged as to where they were in the organization. So it really worked for us. It was the opposite of the exodus, I would say. It really helped us to keep people within our organization.
Right.
At that point. And it just expanded. I mean, this has now gone across our whole organization from then till 2015. And then from 2015, every business within the group got it. So we've had now, from 2015 to 2023, we've had 8 years of the business doing this, and it's not going away. It's just getting stronger and stronger. In fact, we're talking about it for the next strategy cycle, which we have coming up, as to what do we do. And of course, this plays a huge role in how we engage our organization and enable them to do their job. And so it's still going to be there, and it'll still be part of it for years to come. It was very unique in 2010. Now, I think other companies are really could be doing other things similar. But we were literally the lone wolf at that point, trying to do something so big in a company that was so, so big.
Absolutely. So let's go to present day. What you know, in your job, your role, you know, engagement, enablement, what's your biggest challenge in this big organization today? What's the, I'm trying to figure this out, push this one through. What are you working on?
Well, there's a number of things now that sit under my remit. So my role, this role I'm in today, I started probably 2.5 years ago in the group, and that was when I left the Express business with the remit to say, look, we're going to really pull all the elements of our culture together. And so, as well as what I've just explained, which was the sort of let's call it the certified organization. So what we do in that space for development, from executive development, leadership development, all the way down. I also have in my remit all the change organization. So how do we deal with change and transformation around the individual transformation? So EI, EQ, but also organizational transformation. And included within that now, on the last 2 or 3 months, we're starting to look at well-being. So what are we doing in the well-being space, which is a big thing for me in the next couple of years. I also have all of our continuous improvement organizations. So what do we do in regards to like our internal Six Sigma, which we call First Choice? What do we do within the organization to enable the businesses all over the world to improve every day for the customer? I also have, and this is really the biggest at the moment, is the diversity space. And so I hold as part of all of that, the diversity, equity, inclusion and belonging organization, which in my view is where it's the biggest thing at the moment in the world anyway. But for big companies, we have a huge, huge responsibility in this space. Because governments in big cultures are not necessarily dealing with it. You're seeing lots of tumultuous times around the world, and companies play a huge role and a big responsibility for their populations. And this is part of it, is saying, how do we as an organization drive a really inclusive, fair, diverse, equitable environment or business that everyone can feel like they belong in? And so I have that as the organization. And then just to top all that off, it's how do we as a company become this sort of great company to work for all? And how do we work with companies like Great Place to Work and Top Employer to really, really qualify our organization to be a great place to be? So that's the sort of remit. But in that remit, the biggest thing which you asked me is really the diversity space.
Got it.
We're really pushing that, and we've had a lot of traction in the last year around what we're trying to achieve. And I'm really pleased with what we've been able to do so far, but it is definitely going to be the biggest challenge for the next 5 years, for sure.
So if I had to summarize what you said was, I don't sleep.
Yeah, I do sleep. I do sleep, believe it or not. Yeah. One thing I pride myself on is my work-life balance. I'll give you that. But yeah, I'm comfortable.
Well, you got a wide, very complex. You went through all kinds of topics, and thanks for that. So, by the way, I don't know how I'm sure there's a large team helping you work on that. I understand the importance of diversity and inclusion. I would agree with you on that. The one thing you touched on that I'd like to unpack a little bit, if you don't mind, would be the EQ training. I think that's fantastic. I haven't heard many companies talk about that. This is something I think about. I think there's a lack of EQ out there. How do you tackle that? Walk me through that. What are your strategies? What are you doing on EQ?
There's nothing specific to say you're now going to do an EQ training. So we don't do that. What we do is we build the models and the thought processes around really the focus on empathy is the biggest thing, actually. But we really sit to think about how can we as an organization of leaders be empathetic to what our organization really is all about, and our people in the organization, do we listen right? Do we really understand what people say, and do they feel that from us? That's really what we've been working on in this sort of, let's say, empathy perspective across all of what I've just said. So it's not one spot, it's across everything. And how do we build it in? But what we do also do in this sort of individual emotional positioning perspective is, how do we build in mindfulness? How do we build in giving people the space to be present in what they do? I hate to use the word meditation because it really does put a lot of people off, but how do we build in techniques around that that can level people's emotional capability and state to ensure that they are present in their organization? We spend a lot of time thinking about what we can do to build into our programs in that space, as well as, say, Search Inside Yourself as an example that Google had for a long time. We use that. We have practitioners in that we offer. But it's more about how we use the techniques and embed them within the organization in our programs.
That's incredible. And do you feel that DHL's culture today is a competitive advantage with where it is today versus a...
Hands down. Sorry to interrupt you there.
No, that's great.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, it's definitely a company with a very unique culture. It draws people in. And once you're in, it's very difficult to get out because the culture's so engaging and motivating for everybody around. Now, I'm sure if people listen to this all over the world, I'm going to get a million emails saying, not in my environment, not in mine. You know, no one's perfect.
But let's talk about that. This is really interesting. I want to stop there for a sec because, of course, you're right. Like, it's impossible to scale to a level that everyone's bought in. But how do you address that? Because it's funny because I see this online all the time. I'll see I was on LinkedIn the other day and I saw the CEO of Walmart and he did a video. I forget the gentleman's name. It's so bad. Anyways, and he was talking about their company culture and this. And then it was just like, doom, bam, 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 bam. He was, you know, it was 1 for 5. He was getting smoked on 4. One person was like, love this company. It's great. And 4 were like, you don't know what's going on around here. Like, what? How do you deal with that if you put something out? And I'm just curious at scale, you know?
Well, I think it comes down to how we deal and empower the leaders at the local level to be able to deal with it. You know, no one in any central organization can deal with all of the ins and outs of where this might not be being embedded. But if we hear about it and we see things and we feel it and we understand it, and you can generally see from the results of the business, to be fair, the results of our employee opinion survey, where we sit on Great Place to Work's trust index, where we sit on top employers index, you see all of that. And you can sort of pinpoint where things are happening. But if you hear the stories, it's about going back to the leaders for me. It's not about the people who are raising it. It's more saying, clearly, these people are not being managed or supervised properly or appropriately. So we go to the leadership and say, what is it that's happening? And what are we, in essence, you can say, what are we not doing? Or what are we doing that's not letting these people be themselves or thrive or, you know, bring their authentic self to work or, you know, enjoy their job? I mean, that's the basics of human need, isn't it? Enjoy your job. So, you know, what are we doing as a team that's not letting that happen? And it's about how we go to the leadership. That's it. So, and that's all I can say. I mean, every now and again, you get emails. I mean, we're always going to get them. You know, it's not going to, we're not in a perfect world.
Absolutely.
We're all trying our best at certainly at scale to take this down for sure.
So you're obviously incredibly passionate about DHL's culture. You can feel it in your energy, your body language. What's something that you find is very different, innovative? We talked about what happened in 2009. That was great. What's happening today that you think this is separating us from the pack? Most companies don't do this. This is where we are really a different company. What's something you can share that would be quite different that you're very proud of?
Yeah, you know, I find that question really difficult to answer. And I'll tell you why. Because I'm not embedded enough. And I've not been in many companies. I've worked in many, many companies. So I can't really say what that experience would be like. And today, what makes us the difference? And I think I feel this. Whether it's true or not, I cannot answer that. But what I think it is that we are in an organization that allows the conversation to take place. It allows people a view. It lets people have an opinion. It doesn't matter whether you're a courier or whether you're the CEO, you have access to everyone. We try our best to keep the hierarchy out where appropriate and culturally relevant, to allow these organizations to have the voice. And I think that's where we are very special in one way. The other way, I think, is that we're very fortunate as an organization that our leadership is willing to take a risk. So what do I mean by that? There's been many times, I would say, over the last, let's say 14, 15 years, that I've been working with the CEO and his team or the corporate board of the group and many of the senior leadership across our organization where they could have stopped everything because some of the things I've been saying and been asking for and saying, let's do it, is so out of everybody's comfort zone. It's really impossible to talk through. So I've not come across any major blockage to say, you know what, you're nuts. This is not going to happen. I'm not going to take that risk. It's always been, okay, let's try it. Let's see what happens. Let's take it as it is. If it goes wrong, we'll fix it. But the leadership have always supported it. And I think for me, that can only be the game changer. Because if we didn't have that, we wouldn't even be able to try some of the crazy wild things that we've done that have worked for us, but also some of the things that we've done that have really not worked. And we've just pulled them back and said, oh, okay, that's not worked. Let's move on. But we would never have had that if we didn't have such an open leadership organization, I'd say. We're super lucky with that. Super lucky.
So I hear two things there. The beginning part was relationships, trust, and safety, if I package that, right?
Yeah.
And then I love the second part about being able to be bold, courageous, move quickly, be nimble, especially in today's world. Because most organizations, to be frank, at your level, have lost, they've exchanged nimbleness with bureaucracy. And it sounds like you haven't done it.
Yes, we have it. We have bureaucracy as well. It's there. No company has none. And sometimes it can be extremely frustrating, but it's there for a reason. Mm-hmm. And one of my whole philosophies with it is just go through it and just keep pushing and keep challenging it in all spaces. Because if you don't, you'll never do anything that's innovative. You'll never do anything that is different and new. And we like to go against the grain here. And to go against the grain means people don't really understand why you would want to do something. So it's about challenging the boundaries of their comfortability. But you're right. You are absolutely right. Bureaucracy can stop anything. And many, many companies have too much of it.
Well, you can tell from your energy. It's not a soul-sucking thing that's happening. I understand. Of course, there's got to be some push-pull. Rick, you mentioned in that last piece of conversation some of the wacky things we've done. What's something that you would put in that box and say, geez, we tried that, and whether it worked or not, well, give us an example.
So the only thing, I'll give you one example, which may not seem so wacky now, but then it was seemed a little bit out there, was that we did two things. I'll give you two examples of this. So one example is many, 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 many years ago, we were looking at our first line managers in our business, our supervisors. Okay, now in our whole global organization and the group, we have about 35,000. But in the business I was working in at that time, the Express business, we had about 4,000 or 5,000. And we were building we made a decision with the board that we were going to focus on this first level manager. Arguably, to be fair, Ron, in my view, this is the most difficult role that anyone will go into in their whole career. Because it's okay when you're in the team, being one of the team, but as soon as you are supervising the team as a first-time manager, that's your biggest career step I think anybody would ever take. Well, after that, it's okay, it's manager to director to senior director to VP, I'm fine. Okay, you're all doing the management bit just a bit higher. That first step is the most crucial. If you get that wrong, then all companies will fail. It's absolutely a given. And so we said, look, we need to do something for this population. And so we built a business school, because we couldn't find one adequately enough outside the organization. So we said, we'll build our own. So we built an internal academy for all of our supervisors around the world in every country. They go through exactly the same, and it's a 12 to 18 month program. And one of the things that we said at the time, which now is not wacky at all, but then we were talking and saying, oh, wouldn't it be great if we gave them something to write, like a tablet, instead of getting workbooks. You know, you went to a pro and you get the workbook and you can write things down and you can take your ideas away. We said, oh, wouldn't it be great if they could just put everything on like a small tablet or something that they had? And so I just literally picked up the phone to the CEO when we had the idea and said, listen, can we buy 10 tablets? I was trying to try something out, buy 10 different ones. He went, go it, do it, do it. So we bought some tablets and we built the whole program in the classroom, but they used a tablet. And we still to this day give every single supervisor across the world a tablet. We struck a big deal with a big company, which I won't say, but we now have tablets in our organization for every single supervisor across the world that we can work with and on for all of their whole program. And so that was a very wacky thing at that moment that really gave us that sort of, let's say, edge, because no one had that. And that gave us lots of other challenges, because you don't have return and repair in every single country of the world. So there was a whole raft of challenges with that, but we did it in every country. It was fine. And then other things, again, it sits around technology, actually, with this.
But sorry, Rick, just in that, I think it's interesting. I just want to point out that it's in line with what you said. It was a bold move, piloted at a very small level. You said 10. And I know you have more than 10 of that level leader in your organization. And so that would have scaled to what in the end? 10 to?
Oh, we've got around 25,000 tablets in the business now, just for that purpose, yeah.
Yeah, like that's bigger than I think maybe some listeners would understand. You started with 10 as a pilot in an organization that large, and good for you. Great. Sorry, second part point.
Go ahead. You know what's interesting actually with that, Ron? We worked it out, and it was a no-brainer, but people don't generally think like this. We worked out how much paper would need to be printed for this program over the course of 18 months for the people to fill things in on. And actually, the amount of paper that was printed, it was cheaper to buy a tablet in bulk.
Wow.
Now, the development of the software on the tablet's slightly different.
That's your mathematical analytical brain coming in handy there.
But the other thing is taking things out of our own comfort zone. So one of the big things for me was, I don't know whether you saw it, you probably did see it. This was years ago now, so I suppose I can say this. But do you remember there was a company in the US called Magic Leap? And they did a really special VR augmented. It was mixed reality. They did VR, AR, mixed reality on goggle headsets. And they did, they were in a space where what I saw on the internet was this giant whale leaping out of a school a sports hall and then dive in, and lots of kids were all there with the goggles on. It's on YouTube. Just you just need to type it in.
Okay.
And I thought, I love this. So I rang the company, we got in contact with them and said, can we do something in this space? So we went to see them and we looked through all of their kit and we put the goggles on, and you can see everything around you, but then you see a dragon flying through, and you know, right, it's all so brilliant. And so we did it. We went in and we trialed and piloted different things, and we used goggles for different reasons around the world in different spaces, working with different companies, not that one, but different companies, and thought, how do we create gamification through virtual worlds so that all supervisors or people who work in warehouses around the world can compete against each other whilst educating them? So giving them the training through the goggles and gamification. So we've piloted and experimented, and we don't have that necessarily everywhere now, but we've been able to take some of those risks with things like that, where we've said, just give me a bit of an innovation playground. Don't ask any questions, just let me play with it for a bit. And then we'll come to you and say whether it's worked or not. And we've just been really lucky that they said, go for it, try it and see how it goes.
I love it.
Yeah, we've been super lucky with that. You know, I can't complain at all, really.
Well, I'll tell you what energized me is sitting here talking to you feels like I'm talking to a startup with these ideas and what you've been doing and pilots. It doesn't sound like I'm having a discussion with an executive at such a large, stable business. You know, it's great. It's really nice to see.
Yeah, we want to keep that startup mentality, to be fair. We always talk about that. And it's interesting that you said it, because within the team, we've always said it feels like a startup. And actually, to be fair, now in that space, that feeling of this is in the certified space that I was telling you about. Nowadays, it's moved from the startup and it feels like it's in its teenage years and we can mature with it and it's moving.
Yeah.
But the diversity space is very much in that now. So I said, I was literally saying, I was doing an interview the other day, and I said it felt like in 2012, when we were going through what we were going through, we realized that we had something super special and we had no idea that we were going to get the golden ticket to move with it. It felt brilliant at that moment. It feels the same today in the diversity space. I really feel like we're getting to that point where we've got something and we've done something very different from many of other organizations that I've spoken to. And I feel like we're going to start to get traction, but give it 4 or 5 years and I think we'll have a very different discussion, but it feels the same. And we've got the same commitment from the board to try different things. We're approaching things in slightly different way than other companies may have done. And so we're trying to say, what can we do that gives us our USP in that space? Because that, for me, the diversity space will drive what's going to happen with companies into the future for sure. So that is, if we get that same feeling, then we've definitely won the game.
Well, Rick, we're out of time, but I tell you, I would love to follow up and hear more about that, because I'm sure we can learn from you as well and a lot of other companies. Well, look, I've absolutely loved this conversation. I've got a few pages of notes here and things to think about. Rick, it's been fantastic to meet you, and love the work you're doing. Love your passion. It shows, and keep it up, and let's stay in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. And great to speak to you, Ron. Definitely. We're very much in common, I think.
For more information about Rick or his work, please follow him on LinkedIn. To learn more about our books or our Scaling Culture Masterclass on how to build and sustain a resilient, high-performing team, please go to scalingculture.org. And lastly, if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a comment and share the podcast with one of your friends or colleagues. We'll be back soon with another incredible guest.